Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and it is time once again for our Favorite Movies of the Year episode. So I am joined for a discussion of our favorite movies of 2013 by Doug.
Hello.
And JB.
I love movies, and I'm so happy to be inside.
This is the fourth year that we've done this. We've done our favorite movie show for 4 years.
It seems like 2009 was a month ago.
Yeah.
This is your favorite show also.
This is my favorite show to do. Yeah. Okay. We have some shows. I like to do our F This Movie Fest show. I like to do our commentaries. I like to do our summer show. But this one is my favorite one to record and listen back to and sometimes masturbate with.
Masturbate with?
Yeah.
My favorite podcast was the Wolfman remake.
So we're going to count down all of our favorite movies. And let's just say right up front, none of us have seen Her, the Spike Jonze movie.
Yeah, that sucks, huh?
We all sort of suspect it might make our list, but none of us have seen it. So
you're rolling that out slowly, yeah. Like another film that opens wide January 10th. Luckily, at least two of us have seen that one.
Yeah, no, I haven't seen those two movies you're talking about. This is Doug talking, by the way. My list is shit. Just going to put that out there right now. There's so much that comes out like around Christmas, and especially...
Yes, this year was way worse than years past.
Everything felt very, very pushed back. Even the Christmas releases were hard to get to, but not only that, but there were the two movies, you're talking about Her and Inside Llewyn Davis, that are wide release January 10th, and you really had to go somewhere to, like, special to see them, and I didn't see either of them. But I also suspect that they both might make my list, which makes me think that this list might change. And I feel, for the first time in 4 years, I feel like... I feel like a man, because I saw hair down there.
And I have 2 weeks off, because I'm a teacher, and I didn't get to every single one. Luckily, the one that I didn't get to, I don't think would have made the list anyway.
Her?
No, probably
but
not.
But who knows? It might show up on one of your three lists. Have you mentioned we haven't seen each other's list?
We have not seen each other's list.
Why so cryptic? You're talking about Her? Is that the...
No, because that really hasn't opened wide. I did not, in the final analysis, I did not make it to MIDI.
No,
I didn't either. Yeah.
It's probably not going to show.
Well, I think that after it came out and I saw, I want to see it eventually, but it wasn't like, I must see this before.
Every review of MIDI can be summarized with meh.
Yeah.
Right.
It's weird because we commented last week when we did our overrated, underrated show, and we've talked a little bit about how... there were a lot of good movies this year.
Yeah.
The critical community sort of at large keeps heralding this. Is like, this is one of the best years for movies ever. I liked a lot of movies this year, but like Doug, I'm less passionate about this list than in years past.
And I had a terrific time this year, and I think maybe, A, I lowered my standards. For instance, I had a hell of a time at Pacific Rim.
Okay.
Just unleashed my 11-year-old.
Which brings me to number 10.
And also, not to brag, but I came so close, I'm going to claim it for the Queen and country. I saw this year almost 3 movies a week in a theater. Yeah. I came this close to 156 for the year. And that's the definition of a good year, isn't it?
Yeah.
Or... obsessive compulsive. I mean,
unless 154 of those are garbage.
But I don't know what you mean by obsessive compulsive, because I just need to go to the movie. I need to go to the movie and then tap the table 3 times. I tap the table 3 times. And after I tap the table 3 times, I tap the table 5 times. But then I go to a movie. And then I go to another movie, and then I tap the table 6 times.
Who went first last year? Do you guys remember?
I think I did. That might be a mistake. But I want to say this about the list, and just one last thing I'll say is that.
To qualify the list, there's
a lot of smaller things I haven't seen.
Yes.
And part of the reason is because I'm lazy.
Right.
Part of the reason is because I have
I don't bother with a movie that costs less than $75 million.
Part of the reason is I have a new baby at home, which is everyone else out here has kids, so I'm not using
this
that as an excuse.
It is the first year you can use
that. No.
That
is a legitimate response. For the longest time, I've been keeping a list, speaking of obsessive compulsive disorder, of all the movies I see. And it's on a computer file. I could go up
and
down.
Those computer files. The up-down computer
files. On this list, my son is born, and there's literally nothing for like a year and a half.
Yeah.
And then, like, we took him to the drive-in.
Because he could scream in the car and not disrupt the patrons.
I understand completely.
But I really did try to see the last few weeks. I've really made a concerted effort. I've seen
probably most of the good stuff came out.
Like five movies a week in the last... few weeks, and I've tried even some smaller stuff, recommendations from Adam Risky, recommendations from JB, recommendations from all the people at the site, and even going back through old comments and seeing what people were saying, like, this movie was great in the summer, and I just happened to miss it. My point is, there's still a few things I haven't seen, and unlike in previous years, I'm not crazy about this list, and I kind of disagree. This year, from what I have seen, nothing is really... I think there's been two movies that have really grabbed me and shook me in a good way.
Would those be your number one and number two?
Secret Life of Walter Mitty. And...
Well, that's two. I saw it in
and
two.
Escape Plan.
Escape Hatch.
You got it right.
I've been calling it Escape
Hatch. I listened to the podcast.
I think that's what it should have been called.
Oh, gosh. All right, so J-Bones, you get to go first this year.
Okay, in the number 10 spot, and I'm fairly certain neither of these films appear on your list.
Neither of these films?
I went with a tie.
Me too. We're the worst.
Assholes.
But I only,
top 11.
I only have a tie for 10th, and
yeah,
then
me
I
too.
And then
me
I
too.
Got serious.
My whole list is ties.
Tied for 10th because I didn't want to leave either of them off. The first one is No.
Okay.
A film from Chile, a film that I went to see over the summer with my son, and it didn't receive a lot of attention. It's about a real-life incident that actually happened in Chile where, to satisfy some UN regulation for foreign aid, Pinochet had to have an election. But Pinochet was a fascist dictator who intimidated people into being against the government and staging. So it was sort of incredible that they had this election anyway. And the opposition of Pinochet actually hired professional advertising people to fashion a campaign against Pinochet, and the campaign was called No, No to Pinochet. So not only was it a fascinating film and a fascinating glimpse into history, but the filmmakers used degraded color film stock and managed to match it with documentary footage of the time, and it's seamless. Hmm. You would think that the actors were really...
What era was this?
This would be in the early 70s.
Okay.
And it was a big surprise. I went in not knowing very much about it. My son had read some things about it. We went to see it and just talked endlessly after the screening about, and we've talked about this endlessly on F This Movie, where a movie is only one thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, this movie was 10 different things and more. It was a political thriller. It was sort of a meditation on politics. It was a meditation on advertising. I won't... oversell the point, but the film No is amazing, and it is slowly showing up on people's 10 best list.
It's so amazing that 10 movies are better than it.
Nine
movies are better. One movie is as good.
I don't see.
I'm kidding.
I don't see a lot of foreign films because I
don't see color. Okay,
that's interesting because two of the films on my list are in black and white, because I didn't want to leave either of these films out on my list. No is tied with Frozen.
Okay.
Which I wasn't going to see and only went to see because of your review, Mr. Bromley. And wow.
You're welcome.
Talk about a film that was missold. I think we talked about this last week.
Yeah.
I was expecting this scary snowman because the movie theater we go to had this really big display of that snowman after he had melted with a grass skirt and it was animated and... This is ugly and horrible. And is this about a snowman and a reindeer?
Is that the movie that features the famous line, "You the man, no, you the snowman"?
That's the one. Yeah,
yes. But they wisely kept the comic relief in perspective. It's actually a movie about two sisters and their troubled relationship with each
other. I'm not taking my son to that.
Exactly. Disney said, we can't sell this. But apparently, because it was released before Thanksgiving and stayed around to the holidays, it made a shit ton of money, right?
Well, yeah, it kind of dropped down if you follow the weekly box office. It kind of dropped down to 4 and 5 as The Hobbit comes out, other stuff comes out, and then around Christmas and New Year's, it shoots back up to number one because all the kids are out of school and people are going. So it's one of those movies that dropped out of number one, then back up to number one. So it's making a bunch of money.
And we've talked about when you go to see any children's film, you see 5 trailers for other children's films.
Eesh.
They're invariably horrible. And
Nut Job.
Oh, my God.
What's the deal with it's an acorn?
And it's the whole thing, it's all just nut puns.
Yeah.
Which is what the movie should have been. Do you remember when your nickname was Nut Puns, by the way?
Oh, those crazy days of high school. It's like that scene in Best of Show with Christopher Guest. I'd sit around naming nuts.
Nut.
So, Frozen is the type of movie that young people should see.
Yeah.
Because it teaches them a whole bunch of really interesting things about the world. that will better equip them to handle.
Do the sisters turn their mother into a bear?
No.
Okay, good.
No. But both of those films I can't recommend highly enough. They are tied for 10th.
I remember you talking about No on the podcast when you had seen it. Yeah. And like, the what have you seen lately? But I never did see it.
Sean Connery is great in that movie.
Don't quote me, but I believe it just was added to Netflix.
Oh, cool. Okay.
No.
I'm
going to quote you.
Maybe that's why no one went to see it, because the advertising campaign worked against them. Do you want to go see this? No? And it becomes an Abbott and Costello routine.
I also have a tie for 10th.
Wait, I'm going last?
Yeah, I thought that's the way you go around.
Oh, that's, no, way. You should go last.
No. He should go last so that we can mock
you. Yeah, that's okay, fine. You go next.
I have a tie for 10th also because I didn't want to leave any movies.
Very interesting. Very pussy.
I didn't want to leave any of these off. I'm upset because I had to leave Stoker off my list. I wanted Stoker to be
on
my list.
Oh, so you have 12.
Certified number 11 slash 12. But my tie for number 10 is sort of, but Stoker's not on my list. All right. But I do have a tie for 10th.
But it's really good. You should all check it.
And the first movie is Your Next.
Okay. That's on higher on my list.
Okay, then.
It is not on my
tabled.
List at all.
Tabled.
I mean, if we're going to do the bit, guys. So we'll talk about Your Next in a little bit. And for me, that is tied with Johnny Toe's Drug War, which is the best crime movie I've seen in a long-ass time. And I've been telling everyone to see Drug War. And I think because the title is so generic, everyone thinks I'm joking.
I think that...
It's a Hong Kong crime film. It's on Netflix Instant currently. It's unbelievable.
I'm not making a joke. I thought it was a documentary.
No.
And then I saw a review. I think you posted on your personal Twitter account that said Drug War, like, kicked my ass.
Something like that. And probably it was probably more clever because I'm a pretty good tweeter.
But I didn't know if that was, was a good thing or a bad thing. Like,
I think...
Because I saw
it,
I was like...
Did I say it kicked my ass in the dick?
No, it didn't. You didn't say that. Oh, that'd be a bad thing. Okay, good. No, you tweeted out, Drug War kicked my ass. And I was ooh. I slammed my computer down.
Okay, good.
It's not even a laptop.
No to Drug War.
And I closed it. And I said, I don't want to see that movie because I don't want anything to kick my ass. I'm a pacifist.
And at Christmas time, you had suggested it to Jake and I.
Yeah.
And we had that reaction. Yeah. Is he joking?
No.
And then there was this silence, and you were like, it's really incredible.
It's unbelievable.
Well, no, you have the right reaction, JB, because at one point, I'm going to tell a quick story, okay?
I think we've told this story on the podcast.
Very quick. I'm in Portland, Oregon with my future wife. We're about to see a movie, either Star Trek, the original, the reboot of Star Trek, or Terminator Salvation. And I had seen Star Trek, but my future wife hadn't, and I had not seen Terminator Salvation. So I text Patrick, and I say, what should I see? And over text, he's like, oh, you should really see Terminator Salvation. And I'm like, in the back of my head, I'm thinking, I think he whipped on it in the past, but he's telling me to see it right now. And I wrote back, I'm like, for real? He's like, oh, yeah. Like, not understanding that sarcasm does not translate well over text.
But I also didn't know that you were literally standing.
Oh, yeah. We're like,
I didn't know it was an emergency because I wouldn't have clouded the message in that situation.
We did not see it. We saw Star Trek and we're better for it. So
he said that irony was the shackles of you. Before, you're right.
That clearly didn't work in text.
You should totally see Terminator Salvation. I didn't even get that tone. That
so my number 10 is Terminator Salvation.
And Drug War is on Netflix.
Yes.
Because I really want to watch it.
It's so good. It's so good.
Is anyone... Who's in it?
Asian people.
Oh, no. I don't see that.
It's a Chinese film. It's subtitled.
Everyone
so
who's
to...
anyone.
Wait. I got to read during my movie?
Yeah, you have to read.
Next thing you'll tell me it's black and white.
It's super, super good, guys. And both of those are, I guess, kind of genre films. And maybe that's why they're tied for 10th. But I think they're the two best genre movies of the year.
Cool. My number 10 is
a
black and white. It's tied for black and tied for white. It's Nebraska.
Okay.
Which I might be on someone else.
And
do you want to shout something out right now?
We will talk about it a little bit later.
That's,
so table?
This is your bit that you're
Jesus,
not even doing.
I had to agree to do the table bit, and now we're not doing
table?
It.
Table?
There we go. All right.
Which brings me back to me.
I'm scratching off as we go.
Okay,
yeah, and I'm writing yours down because this will be my to-do list.
This is how neuroses
work. Oh, you should see the to-do list. I'm just kidding. Don't see the to-do list.
No.
Garbage
Isn't
that movie.
Bill Hader's wives?
Yeah.
Wives?
His wives.
He's a Mormon.
I remember he actually went out and did some press for that.
He did. That was a mistake.
Yeah.
That movie's not good.
I thought this was a particularly good year for documentaries. Two documentaries made my list, and a couple others are on my list of runners-up. And my number nine film is 20 Feet from Stardom,
okay,
which I believe I've talked about on the podcast before. It's a documentary about backup singers. What could have been sort of a tossed-off basic cable melange, sort of an excuse to play a bunch of tunes that people know. It was unbelievable. The people they got to interview were incredible. I've said this before, that they got them back in the studio to sing and to actually give you, in a way, it's sort of a concert film, but it's so much more. I'm not sure if it's on Netflix yet, but
I don't believe it is.
And I hate to say it, I want to see it, but Netflix probably isn't the way to see it.
Well, I was lucky in that I saw it in a theater, but I told the story before on the podcast with, yeah, at the boozy,
right,
pool table.
I saw it at the Boozaplex.
I saw it at the Boozaplex 20, and there were some people who had never learned how to act in a public place. But again, the film was so good that didn't ruin it.
Right.
And I just was glad that I got to see it with a really cool sound system, because there is a lot of music in it, and it's terrific.
All right, cool. I still haven't seen it. I feel terrible. Terrible.
It's very much worth your time.
You should feel terrible.
I feel terrible.
Well, good.
My number nine is The World's End.
Tabled.
My number nine is Iron Man 2.
Through this shit. It's so good.
It came back.
From it was re-released
3 years later. Listen, Iron Man 2 is underrated, okay? No, my number nine is just as laughable.
You keep telling yourself that shit.
It's not Iron Man 3, but okay, it's just as laughable.
All right.
Okay, let me just give a little clarification that I have not seen all these great documentaries and all these little indie. Patrick was, he's a member of many online associations and critics associations and things. He gets invited and knows people. He rubs elbows with Kane Hodder.
Totally.
He gets invited to Lloyd Kaufman's bar mitzvah.
Yeah.
And he's often at these critics. You did. And his bris, too.
I was there when he met Kane Hodder at Days of the Dead. Kane Hodder beat the shit out of him.
So good, because
I've seen it. He was on the ground, like, begging for mercy of some sort, and he's like, shut up, bitch, I'm Kane Hodder.
Yeah, now I have my shirt that says I got beat up by Jason.
Which he sells, but he made you pay for it.
Yeah.
Literally.
Okay, so my point is, I did not see all these these indie twee movies that Patrick is so fond of.
Yes, exactly.
Why does every one of Doug's picks have a qualification?
Oh, everyone don't. Just wait.
Did you notice the whole qualification is just to make fun of me? For something I didn't do. He's making fun of me.
Now, before I say my next pick, I have to make fun of Patrick for seeing so many movies.
I mean, I'm happy to be part of this film set, but if I had known that seeing all these movies was a prerequisite for me participating, I would have bailed years ago, is my point. My number nine is laughable, and you could all go to hell. At first, I did not think it would make my list, but two things happened. One, I didn't see enough movies. And number
two, Patrick said, it's time to record the podcast.
I said, shit. And two, the movie's actually gone up in my estimation. When I first saw it, I was like, oh, that's good, and I've been thinking more about it. It's, laugh all you want, it's The Hunger Games: Catching Fire. I like that movie. I think it, the first Hunger Games was on my list from...
Last year, I think.
Last year or 2 years ago?
I can't remember.
I can't either.
I feel like it was last year.
And I actually feel like this movie is a better movie than the first movie, and it wasn't going to make my list at first, because it feels almost like a filler. Obviously, it's a trilogy, and it bridges the final film, which comes out next year. But it's grown in my estimation. I think it's better done. I think it doesn't have to do all the legwork that the first movie had to do, which saves it from a lot of the horribleness. It also benefits greatly from Philip Seymour Hoffman and Donald Sutherland acting as adults do. It does not benefit from, what's his name, Josh Hutcherson, who is at best a six. Gale is an eight, maybe a nine. PETA is a six, maybe a five. He needs to cut his hair. No, in all seriousness, Josh Hutcherson is a mushmouth, mumblemouth.
Yeah, he's really not good.
A really, really bad actor who I want to... And PETA is kind of the emotional link
everything,
to the movie.
Everything hinges
and
on him.
And it sucks because I like Jennifer Lawrence. I think she does a good job.
Yeah.
You got Woody Harrelson, who does, you know, good work. And then you've got these two heavyweights pulling the weight of all these other people.
Right.
And I liked it. I really enjoyed it. And again, it wasn't going to make my list, but Patrick said, Doug, I'm pressing record, and I had to write something down in the ninth spot.
I actually thought there was a lot to like. I thought it wasn't as good as its parts, I thought it was interesting that, you know, everyone in that film is dressed so crazy because it's this dystopian future. And I thought, as we were watching, I think I turned to my wife and I said, yeah, they had a crazy outfit for Phyllis Diehl Hoffman. But he said, no, I'm not wearing that.
I was really nice.
Compared to everyone else, he's wearing street clothes and pulls it off. You know what I like most about the movie, though? Stanley Tucci. And
yeah. He was the best part of the first one, too.
Yeah, you might argue that what he's doing is easy, but think about all the things we've seen him in. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking specifically Julie and Julia, where he's terrific, and of course Big Night, which I've talked about. Has he ever given a bad performance?
The Lovely Bones. Mm. But I want to say he was nominated for an Oscar for that movie. I'm not even joking.
So
it just goes to show that fuck everything.
I think Catching Fire is a much better made movie, actually, which surprises me because it's Francis Lawrence, and I remember it came up, I think, last year when you had talked about it and you said, who's doing the next one? I said, Francis Lawrence. You said, what did he direct? And I said, like, I Am Legend, and we both went, oh, well. But I think it's a better made movie. I feel just a little bit like it's about less than the first movie was.
Yeah, you know, I agree.
It's more about just advancing this plot.
Oh, no, I can't defend this choice at all.
No, and there were technical things I liked a lot.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert, that whole spinning thing I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah. Did you happen to see it in IMAX?
I did not.
I saw it in IMAX, and when they get into the arena, it opens up to full
very cool
IMAX. That stuff was shot,
You had warned me ahead of time. It was kind of subtle, but it was cool.
It was cool, and it's jarring when it switches back.
Well, like the original opening of when the Road Warrior opened, it was in Academy ratio, and then when we hit the ground, it opened up, and everyone in the theater, because remember
freaked
when that
out.
No, everyone in the theater was like, it was the coolest thing we'd ever seen.
Ghost Protocol did that, too, a lot. Like, when they had the Vistas, they went to IMAX. Ghost Protes, yes. My number one from a couple years ago. Listen, it's all about how much fun I'm having in the theater.
Yeah, and you're a fan of the series. And
I am. I'm also a little girl inside me. No,
sure.
And also in the trunk of my car.
Julianne Moore is showing up in the next two, so they just keep adding.
There's two more movies?
Yeah, they're splitting. Of course they're going to split the last one in two.
Yeah.
Because there's so much story to cover. Just kidding. I like that they keep adding heavyweights.
I like that Philip Seymour Hoffman's character is named
Plutarch Havensby. Horrible name.
The Desolation of Plutarch's Haven.
Oh, man.
Right.
J-Bones, I don't even remember.
Eight?
Okay.
We're on number eight.
Yeah.
I enjoyed the hell out of this film, and then I talked to you about it briefly, and then it slipped a little
bit. Limited to my number eight.
It slipped a little bit down my list, but I can't deny, and my son saw it when he got back to L.A., and he had something very interesting to say about it. But I just had a great time. My number eight film is American Hustle.
Okay. Not on my list.
Not on my list.
Yeah.
Okay. It has been pointed out to me that it seems to be an ersatz Martin Scorsese film.
Yeah.
And why would you pick that when this year you had a real Martin Scorsese film? But as my wife pointed out, Martin Scorsese has become a genre.
Yeah.
And it's possible for other filmmakers to explore that genre. My son's comment, which I'd like to share with all of our listeners, is my son thought it was interesting that everything good in the movie has nothing to do with the plot.
Yeah.
That it's ornamentation.
And that's part of the disconnect. I liked the movie. I had fun watching it, and all the actors are really good, and the music's great, and it's very showy, and he directs it very confidently. But when it was over, I just felt like, my hands kind of close on air.
You know? And I think it was Risky who pointed out that what is the twist, that what is the trick? But I think there was one that throughout the entire film, the Christian Bale character is clearly the smartest guy.
Right.
He doesn't get arrested. He manages to get Jeremy Renner back into the fold. And that scheme that he comes up with at the end, I thought was honestly clever.
Sure.
I really liked, you might laugh at me, I really liked Robert De Niro's cameo in that. I actually wanted more of him. And then when he left, I felt like Christian Bale was just doing a De Niro impersonation almost. So I thought it was so cool,
and maybe we should have said spoiler alert, because one of the things I really
Is that a spoiler? That
he's, well,
at this point, it's not really. No. At this point, but it wasn't advertised that he's in the movie. It was.
Can you rewind?
Yes.
Is it the rewind button?
Yeah.
When he shows up, it was a great surprise.
Yeah.
because usually that leaks out. It was like Bill Murray in Zombieland. It was right. this nice little
right.
drug. Yeah, there again. And when De Niro puts the glasses on, he looks so much like his character at the end of Casino, where he's older, and now he's got this desk job, and he puts the glasses on, that you can almost think that's the same character, and that's where he ended up.
It just feels like De Niro is, I mean, we've talked a lot about how he's just takes any role, and he's kind of a shell of his former self. He was legitimately scary. I thought his performance
was
like
terrific.
It, just really, really great. I will say this is a kind of a, not about the movie, but I saw this movie in Los Angeles, and it was a very diverse theater, lots of different types of people. And about 5 minutes in the movie, I'm smelling fish, like legitimate fish smell. And I'm like, either a person's got their foot, like a sock, right by my face.
Like a fish foot.
Or I turned around and said, no, it was an Asian man eating sushi behind me. It was a horrible movie-going experience, and I want to see this movie again. And here's my qualified, I liked it a lot, just like Patrick said. In my mind, it might be a great movie. I'm just having, I thought a lot of it, I thought the first part was a little slow and also smelled like fish.
The first couple minutes, it had Apocalypse Now syndrome for me. And part of my reaction to it, honestly, may be I was more excited about this movie than maybe any other one this year because I just thought the trailer was so great. It had a little bit of Apocalypse Now syndrome for me because the first 5 or 10 minutes I thought were so great that they spend all this time on Christian Bale doing the comb over. I love how much time they devoted to that. And then you get the three of them walking down the hall to what song? Dirty Work? It's not Dirty Work, but it's you know, one of the 100 famous songs from the 70s that's on the soundtrack. So, so great. And for the first couple minutes, I was like, well, this is the best movie of the year. And then, obviously, the rest of it...
What do you think about Amy Adams?
Listen, we don't need to talk about my feelings about
I'm just
Amy Adams right now. I found her... I was distracted.
What do you think about her side boob?
I was distracted whenever she was on camera.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
I am not a fan of David O. Russell.
Okay.
And
really?
No, I really am not.
Okay.
I liked his first two films, and then I thought he sort of went astray.
Three Kings? You don't like Three Kings?
No, I love Three Kings.
Flirting with Disaster?
Flirting with Disaster is
the... Spanking the Monkey is first, technically.
Okay, and that's okay,
right.
But
Flirting
with
Disaster, Three Kings.
Three Kings.
Yeah.
Which I, what I thought were his first two movies.
Yeah.
I Heart Huckabees, I have a big problem with. We've talked about this.
Yeah.
And Silver Linings Playbook, we had an even longer conversation.
What about The Fighter? Do you like The Fighter?
No, that's Darren Aronofsky.
No.
Oh, no, I'm confusing with The Wrestler.
Yeah.
No, I like The Wrestler. I like The Fighter. I just want to fight my way out of it. I found American Hustle to be so assured in what it was doing. In fact, a couple weeks ago we were discussing this, and I believe you said, I'm paraphrasing you horribly, that it was very assured being a Martin Scorsese film, and there's a Martin Scorsese film that's even more assured,
yeah.
But we'll talk about that. It was one of the funnest times I had at the movies this year. It's just, I don't think the movie ever took a misstep.
Okay.
I like Jeremy Renner a lot, and I don't
like
Bradley
Cooper a lot.
I don't like Jeremy Renner in almost anything. I kind of find him annoying.
Even in Ghost Protocol, your number one movie?
No, I don't like I don't like him that much in Ghost Protocol.
And as you pointed out...
But I liked him a lot as this little...
He's really good.
He's really good at this.
Everybody
character.
Is actually really good.
As Patrick pointed out, one of the great moments in movies this year was Bradley Cooper's impression of Louis C.K. sitting
on
that couch.
That was somebody else, but yeah.
And... Wow.
I thought Bradley Cooper was really, really good. And again, part of that is because David O. Russell, while I'm starting to take some issue with his emphasis on style over substance, he's really, really good with actors. And Bradley Cooper is very well cast as
Zach Lodge.
As a douchebag.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, I worry that I'll never be able to see Bradley Cooper in a role where I'm supposed to like him, you know?
Yeah, well,
because he's so good at playing an arrogant prick.
Right, yeah, he really is.
But I thought all the performances were really good, and I had fun watching it, and I can see it being a movie that I go back to a bunch of times,
yeah.
Even if I liked it
rewatchable
less than others.
Go back to Bradley Cooper and Wet Hot American Summer.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. What's next for me?
Number eight.
My number eight is Spring Breakers. Is that on anyone else's list?
Nope.
No, okay.
Crickets.
I thought it was great. The end. We have a whole podcast on it, so maybe you should listen to
Maybe you should listen to it.
it was terrific. It was so much more than what you thought it was going to be. It barely missed my list. It was great.
Just a fascinating combination of sort of art and trash. And I've never really seen a movie like it, even though I wouldn't say it's so super original, but just the way that he approached the material. And so many movies that came out this year, and even that are on our lists, are sort of about a similar thing, which is about the shittiness of the American dream.
Yeah.
And Spring Breakers is very much about that. American Hustle is sort of about that. A movie that's way higher up on my list is about that. A very polarizing movie. As I would look at other critics' top 10 lists, it would get mentioned, and then I would scroll down to the comments, and without fail, there would be a number of comments that said, this list is garbage because you have Spring Breakers on it. Like, I That's refuse crazy. To take this list seriously because Spring Breakers is a piece of shit. And I understand why it would turn people off, and that's fine.
Yeah, but you understand why it would turn off, like, the Disney set, the people that went to see Vanessa Hudgens.
I mean, it's very aggressive in its color scheme. The music is very loud. Isn't that, sort of that bass heavy. Yeah.
There's some disturbing things in the film, and I think sometimes in movies there's fake disturbing, what idiot filmmakers think will be disturbing, and then there's someone who can really tap into it, like David Lynch.
Right.
There's some stuff in Spring Breakers that's honestly disturbing.
Yeah.
Here's what I think. I think we found a critical litmus test. If you think Pain and Gain is kind of a critique of American masculinity, that's okay, you're full of shit.
Right.
And if you think Spring Breakers is exploitative and is not doing what you're falsely claiming Pain and Gain is doing, you're wrong. Because Spring Breakers was a critique of that hidden within an exploitation film.
Have you seen it multiple times? Have you seen it?
No. I saw it once in the theater, and I watched it once on Blu-ray because I reviewed it for DVD Verdict. I haven't gone back to it.
I'm just curious. Do you think, is it a kind of movie that you like are longing to watch again? Or?
No.
No?
Because a lot of it was unpleasant. I mean, it was... I liked the ending so much. This happens to me a lot. I liked the last shot and the music that they used so much that when I think about going back to rewatch it, it's just so I can get back to that point. Why I always want to watch Inception, because I love the end so much that I just have to watch it just to get back to that place. But no, it's not a movie that I'm
just
like
curious. And that obviously isn't like a criteria for loving a movie, obviously. Yeah. Sometimes you kind of only need to see something once or twice or whatever. I was just curious because I've seen it once. I want to see it again, but I have no desire to see it again.
Right.
And I think what JB said, maybe it's because it's unsettling.
It's a crazy, it's this weird part art film, part party movie, part Disney movie. I mean, it's all these different things. And again, I'm not somebody, and a lot of the critics who wrote about this movie on their top tens would say the same thing, which is, I'm not normally a Harmony Korine fan, and I haven't seen enough of his movies. The little bit that I'm familiar with has never done anything for me. So obviously this feels like his most commercial movie, even if I don't know how commercial it is. I mean, it obviously is because it's like fun. It's guns and music and girls in bikinis.
And A-list celebrities.
Right.
Too. Right.
Yeah, I mean, the movie, if nothing else, is worth seeing just for James Franco's incredible performance.
Yes. I don't want to spoil it.
Yeah.
My number 8 is a movie that snuck up on me. I had no plans to see it.
It's behind you right now.
Oh, my God. That's a skeleton. I had no plans to see it, and it got some good word of mouth. Was Prisoners. I saw this movie. Anyone else's list? I don't think so.
It would have been on my honorable mention.
Right. And it's that kind of movie where I had, and again, not to qualify this too much, but I had no desire to see it. It was a movie that I felt like I knew what it was before I saw it.
Yeah.
There's so many movies out there that come out. I for whatever reason, like Aaron Brockovich comes to mind, where it's this movie is presented and it's this star and this plot and this trailer, and you know exactly the movie you're going to get.
Yeah.
I saw the trailer for Prisoners. I'm like, I know exactly that movie. It's a cross between Mystic River and Snow Angels, and it's dark and depressing. I don't need a bummer movie like that. And it actually turned out to be, I mean, it is not an uplifting movie by any means. It's definitely a heavier movie, but it's got an unbelievable performance by Jake Gyllenhaal. It's a more procedural, I think.
Yeah.
which I'm always attracted to. I like a Zodiac type movie where they kind of go through the steps of an investigation. And it really did like kind of sneak up on me. I found myself really fascinated by how it got to where it got to, which is to say the ending, and not just, I'm not going to spoil anything, but the ending's a little on the nose.
It's not the best thing about, it's like with any mystery or any.
Right. You need to have a resolution, a conclusion. Like,
As soon as you explain stuff, it's less interesting.
It's less,
than
for sure. But
the build up,
the road to get there is just like you're going down these paths, and you're rooting for all the characters. Like you could find something to empathize with in every single person on the screen, and it was really interesting. I again, not normally my cup of tea, but I really enjoyed it.
I rewatched it the other night with Erica, who hadn't seen it, and it was funny to sort of watch it through her eyes because things would get introduced, and she would just be like, what the hell?
Right.
The priest's house, the first time they go to the house.
Yeah.
She's like, what the hell is this? I had the same reaction. I really thought it was going to be, my kids are murdered.
Right.
Which, I'm not making fun of murdered kids, just that it was really going to be 2 hours of grief porn, I think is what I described it. And it's not. It's this procedural mystery, and it's very well done, and it gives the audience credit for a lot of things. It's very patient. I remember after I saw it opening weekend, some people that I talked to were complaining about the ambiguity of the ending.
The ending
is not even a little bit ambiguous. Not even a little bit. But they clearly all wanted it to go on 10 seconds longer.
Well, right, yeah.
Amazing photography, too, by Roger Deakins, who shoots, I think it's Michigan, and it's very gray and snowy and slushy.
It's actually shot
very beautiful.
I think it was Atlanta. Or Georgia.
I thought it takes place
In Pennsylvania.
In Pennsylvania?
I think so.
I don't know why I have Michigan.
No, it's just, I mean, yeah, it's really well done.
It's not on my list.
What's interesting, too, I think a lot of the credit will, not credit, but a lot of the kind of accolade for acting might go to Hugh Jackman.
Yes.
Because Hugh Jackman has a definitely showier, flashier...
He gets to shout.
And, right, but it's...
Because we're used to nice guy Hugh Jackman.
It's Jake Gyllenhaal all the way.
Yes.
Which is, weirdly, again, it kind of snuck up on me, has become like, wow, this guy, I never thought of him... I never really had an opinion about Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah.
I don't dislike him, I didn't like him, but you watch something like this, it's like, I want to see more of him in movies.
But it's Viola Davis, it's Melissa Leo, it's Paul Dano, it's Maria Bello. It's a movie like American Hustle where every part is a fucking heavy hitter. Like,
it's Terrence Howard until it's Don Cheadle. I got it.
No,
it's just weird that midway through the movie they replaced him.
Someone told me, I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah.
Someone told me that the reason to see it was Gyllenhaal.
Yeah.
I don't want to oversell it to you. It's not an art film, it's a commercial.
Right.
Whatever, but it's a fun
reason I didn't see it, besides the fact that life is too short. And as you yourself said, there's so many movies that come out. I wrote that down. I really like that.
Well, again, this film said I thought I'd just casually see some movies. I got to see all these movies.
My wife and I go to see a lot of the many movies that come out, and we saw that trailer dozens of times. And
oh, it's a bummer.
As a parent.
Yeah, right.
It's apparent. I don't want to be a shrinking violet, but I said, I don't know if I feel like putting myself through that.
Right.
Hey, I have a 9-month-old daughter at home, and I was like,
it's kind of worst thing you could possibly imagine happening.
And that's the one thing that I've tried to tell people when talking about the movie is like, it's not that, you don't want to say what it is, but you just want to explain, like, it's not that.
It's not that, but my wife and I talked about, like, we're still not letting our daughter go anywhere when she gets older.
Right.
Like, she's not leaving the house.
You also shouldn't let her see prisoners. She's far too young.
She's a prisoner.
That's where I thought it was going.
It was, for me, it's kind of like this year's The Town, or there's a couple, it's like, hey, every Hollywood movie, be at least this good.
Yeah, no, it should be the
bar for the average.
The mean.
Yeah, it's mean.
It's mode.
J-Bones.
My number seven film, and continuing what Patrick said, is the theme of the year, The Shitty American Dream.
Yay!
I don't think there's a shot in... My number seven film is Nebraska.
Okay.
And I liked it for a bunch of reasons, but there's one shot in Nebraska that I think encapsulates what you're talking about. It's when they go to the aunt's house and all of the brothers are sitting watching television, and this is it.
Yeah.
This is what your life adds up to. I've always
watching
been
Golden Girls, by the way.
They were watching. Those two brothers.
Who aren't
obsessed,
related, by the way, but are they are
who are obsessed with how long it takes
and
you to drive.
And one of them
things.
Is Buzz from Home Alone.
For real?
Yeah.
That's so great.
I didn't know that.
He's balding now. But
and Buzz is Balding.
I've always been a fan of Alexander Payne. You know, you had brought up the cinematography in Prisoners. I thought the cinematography in Nebraska was just unbelievable. And I know Patrick pointed out that Francis Ha was shot in color and then converted.
Right, right.
Clearly, Nebraska was designed for this.
Yeah.
I think so.
It was. Yeah, it was. Okay.
Yeah. Apparently helps.
It was shot digitally, though, too, which I thought was surprising because it almost has the rich, grainy depth of a film.
Right. And I thought when Nebraska came out, there was this big push, like, maybe this will finally get Bruce Dern the Oscar he deserves. And then there was, I noticed a backlash against that.
Yeah.
That critics were saying, well, he had the easy part, and Will Forte was actually doing all the heavy lifting. But I've always been a fan of Bruce Dern, and I suspect the reason I responded to the film the way I did was very personal, that I had an elderly mother who went through some changes, and it's very, very difficult. And, of course, as you know, she passed away this year. And I thought there were details of that experience that the film got exactly right, that you never know when the person is lucid and when the person is not quite lucid.
Right.
So what is real and what and when are they gaming you and when is it fake? But, and you had mentioned this is one of your favorite movie moments. When you get down to it, I don't want to spoil it, what Will Forte realizes at the end of the film, how really little it would take to give his father what he wants.
Yeah.
It made me think that that's a message that I haven't seen in a lot of films, because all of us are busy and all of us have 100 things going on, and that sometimes we think it's much harder to tend to our parents than it really is.
I liked the movie a lot, and I like how Alexander Payne, so many of his movies do get the details right, which you brought up, and sometimes it's just about a location. We were talking about that just before we started recording. It's the way that a waitress looks in a diner, or the way that a sky happens to be photographed. And Nebraska, which, if we extend this to a top 15, would have been on my list. For a little while, I wasn't quite with the movie, and I felt like it was Alexander Payne on autopilot, the way that Wes Anderson sometimes gets, you know.
Sometimes.
I mean? But just like, okay, we kind of know now what an Alexander Payne movie looks and feels like. And as it went on, I thought it just got better and better and better, and things started to come into focus. You know, before the movie had come out, I was hearing so much about June Squibb's performance, and it's so great. And for the first half, at least, of the movie, I just thought, well, she's this awful shrew, and this movie seems to hate her, and okay, she gets the funny lines, whatever. But then she has a moment where she's kissing Bruce Dern's head.
Yeah.
Where the whole thing came into focus for me, and I was like, oh my gosh, that is so great right there. And yeah, by the time you get to that last scene, the whole thing has come together.
But I actually thought the mousetrap moment for me was, and you had mentioned heavy hitters doing great performances in other movies this year, I thought Stacy Keach was just the most amazing douchebag, just the most transparent, awful, evil man.
Yeah.
But I thought he had one of the best lines. I mean, movies have taught us to respond in certain ways, and when he turns to Will Forte and says, she's a bitch. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But then you get a scene where it sort of explains how she or why she's acting that way.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And it's very clear that there's a whole history, and I thought that was really interesting.
One of my favorite moments that didn't make the list was when she shows the gravestone of this boy she dated, who she broke up with because he was so boring. All he wanted to talk about was seeds. When she bares her private area to the gravestone to show him what he missed out on.
Douglas, this was on your list, too.
Yeah, no, I saw the movie today, and I'm still digesting it.
Yeah,
but it was one of those things where I think I very much respond to what you said in terms of how it starts, and it's like it kind of sputters a little bit at first, and it's, I'm like, what is this? Because I also saw previews before it for Inside Llewyn Davis and Her, and I'm like, I almost want to see these. Like, I know I want to see those for sure. And Nebraska, I knew I wanted to see because I love Alexander Payne, and I like all the performers. It kind of, it took a while for me to kind of sink into it. And once I did, though, and again, kind of what you said, JB, with personal experiences, there's, you can't, there's a lot to take if you have gone through an aging parent and things like that. And it's he just gets a lot of the notes right. And I don't know what to say. It's really just a good movie that I don't feel like I want to watch again right away. But
I think it's rewatchable. Another thing I'm forgetting, Bob Odenkirk.
Yeah.
How many of these little masterful performances is he going to turn in? And it would be so easy to make him the asshole son.
Right.
But he's not. And one of the most joyous things in movies this year was when the two of them steal the compressor.
That was a great moment, yeah. Although, I got to be honest, when Bob Odenkirk, his first couple lines, I had a really hard time.
It's always jarring. Yeah, because it's Bob Odenkirk, and you're always like, well, he's Bob Odenkirk. So it is always a weird adjustment. Like, right, I have to take him seriously. He's not Mr. Show Sketch.
Will Forte, that was great.
It's very interesting that he's the person who's gotten out.
Right.
I mean, and yet he's not a douche at all.
Mm.
He shows up. He does his part. And I don't think this is a spoiler. When they eventually get to the publisher's clearinghouse office, and they find out, oh no, people come by all the time. It's can have a hat. amazing.
I really liked too this scene with the woman who talks about how she used to
The newspaper office.
Holy cow.
Peg Nagy?
Yeah.
And I thought that was the small town version. She's the small town version of the internet. Because she brings out this amazing, it's biblical, it's this enormous bound copy of the newspaper. Oh, here we go.
Right.
She's the town's Google.
And again, she has that thing that Alexander Payne gets in a lot of his movies where it feels less like that's not a professional actor. Alexander Payne just found that person. What do you guys think about, there's a massive backlash against him, and the Coens get it too, that all of his movies are sneering and condescending towards the Midwest and towards all of the characters.
No.
That shot of all the men watching TV like zombies is this critique of this is what they're like in the Midwest, and aren't these people pathetic?
I don't think so, because in the same way that you have these caricatures in Raising Arizona, where suddenly at the end we have so much affection for them, and the end of that movie always makes me cry. A similar thing happens in About Schmidt, a film I'm not the biggest fan of.
Me either.
But I find the end, when he gets the letter from the boy, to be very moving.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in those moments, I don't think it's sneering.
I have a hard time thinking that that's what he's after in Nebraska, especially when, again, without spoiling anything, when you get to where the movie gets, it's clear that that's what Alexander Payne wants for the Bruce Dern character. What Will Forte sort of achieves for Bruce Dern is to me, what it seems like Alexander Payne wants for that character, too. And if you can want that for your character, how can you be looking down on him?
And not to be too simplistic, but Alexander Payne is from Nebraska.
Right.
And he's like, I don't know, I think that if... I think, like the Coens in Fargo, like, yeah, are they making... But no, some of the most lovable characters...
Right.
Like Frances McDormand's character in Fargo is one of the best characters that's ever existed in cinema.
I think there's a wide gulf between recognizing the aridity of living there and mocking it.
Right.
I think he's recognizing it.
Yeah, I've never felt like he's mocking, but he takes a lot of shit for being somebody who mocks it.
And one of the reasons that the shot we're talking about is so effective is there are people... What, he made it? Oh, that never happens.
Right.
No, that happens quite a bit.
Yes, absolutely. What are we at?
Seven.
My seven?
Yes.
Okay, my number seven is a documentary called Stories We Tell, directed by Sarah Polley. And
I loved her in John Adams.
Sure. another movie that kind of snuck up on me because she's playing a very specific game, and for the first at least half hour I was very irritated by the game. I felt like the whole thing was very sort of pretentious and navel gazing, and isn't my family quirky and intelligent and literate, and the whole thing felt, oh gosh, it was really rubbing me the wrong way. And then of course the longer the movie goes on, the more you see sort of what it's up to and what it has on its mind. It's about her looking into this one aspect of her family. The less you know about the movie, the better off you are.
Is it about her family?
Yes.
Oh, weird.
Okay. Yes. And so it's very interesting in that way, just as an example of someone realizing that her parents were people before, you know what I mean? We all have a way of forgetting that, oh, my parents were people, and Nebraska is sort of about the same thing. But also one of the things that I really liked about it too was the way that it's about the process of storytelling, specifically as it relates to film, that it plays these games, and I don't want to give away what they are. We're trained to look at things certain ways. So if a movie is shot this way, it's true. This, if it has a documentary aesthetic, we just accept, oh, that's real. But if it looks like this, we know that it's fictional. And the movie does some stuff with that that I thought was really, really interesting. And it has at least two of my favorite kind of reveals of the entire year. I think it's really moving and really smart, and boy, I just thought it was really, really good.
Is it on Netflix Instant?
That was my next question.
It is not.
What the fuck?
I'm very sorry. It is available on DVD currently. Mm. So you can just go to a Blockbuster and rent it.
Speaking of Blockbuster, my son was home for the holidays.
Yes.
And discovered some Blockbuster gift cards from Yuletide's past that we think he might have redeemed some of the value for video games or something. But he was like, oh, I can't use these anymore.
he can't like it online, like maybe? Like
they're presents, like, yeah, maybe you can buy them.
He kind of threw them aside. I don't think he has any interest.
He burned them in the fire.
Too much work.
He's not going to go back to that. That's a closed chapter of his life.
Stories We Tell is really good.
My number seven, and this is the most fun I had at the theater. It's not necessarily a good movie, although the movie knows what it is. And R.I.P. Paul Walker, Fast and Furious 6.
Yes.
It's just a dumb action movie, but it was, right. Again, it was, there's, we have a whole podcast on it. There's not much to say that we haven't already said a billion times. It's just tons of fun, which is also Patrick's nickname in high school. It's like
whatever, nut
before, before he lost the weight.
So yeah, check out Fast and Furious 6 if you know how to have fun.
Again, when a genre movie knows exactly what it's doing and does exactly what we want, there's very few things more satisfying.
Well, right, and it's like, you know, I hem and haw, and my list is definitely the more pedestrian.
Let's call it populist plebeian list.
But I think that, like, when I come down to these movies and, like, what I remember about specific years and my experiences, I mean, I remember watching this movie with you, Patrick, at the theater, and then recording the podcast and just how it's been in my brain. And then, of course, not to sound too sappy, but the tragic death of Paul Walker, like, it's kind of made me think about it almost every day. And I'm thinking, why? And at first I'm like, I can't put that on my top 10 list. That would be ridiculous. And it's like, no, fuck that. This is F this movie.
Yeah.
So Fast 6.
We like what we like.
Gentlemen, help me out with this. I have not seen any of the Fast and Furious films. Okay. I have avoided them all.
Yeah.
Would it be possible to watch 6? And not be in the dark about...
Yeah, you could.
You could, but no, you can't. You really can't, because... And then that's one of the things...
But you have to go through the shit, then, to get to the fun stuff.
Do I have to watch the Tokyo one?
Yes.
Yeah.
But you don't
need...
For
6 to truly make sense, you actually do it. But again, that's one of the things I like about the movie. It's true of, like, the Planet of the Apes series. It's true of the Saw series. When a series gets caught up in crazy continuity...
It's a mythology.
I love it. And Fast and Furious 6 is definitely... This is not a spoiler. 6 brings you back to Tokyo Drift. Tokyo Drift, it turns out, took place in the future. They went back for 4, 5, and 6. By the time 6 ends, you're caught up with Tokyo Drift.
So it's like Escape from the Planet.
Yeah.
I don't know if the time commitment necessary here.
I can't know. Knowing your tastes, too, I don't know if you'd be down, but... It's a fun action movie, but
there's a scene
you really have
where
to check your brain at the door.
In slow motion that I remember from the trailer.
That was from Fast 5.
Probably a couple of those scenes.
Okay.
That was from Fast 5 where they jump off
the
train.
Oh, yeah, where they...
Yeah, I know you love them.
Yeah.
You check your brain door.
My number 6 film, and the second one on my list that was in black and white, Francis Ha.
Yes.
I've spoken of the film on the podcast many times. It was one of the few films this year where... I liked it more the more I thought about it. Conveniently, the Criterion disc came out. I watched it again. Love every minute of it. I felt it gave me insight into my son's generation over break, my son said something very funny. I'm going to ruin the joke by paraphrasing it. He was like, yeah, it showed you something about my generation. Something wrong with my generation.
Yeah.
But obviously, I'm a big fan of Noah Baumbach and have liked all of his films, although I was reading, this wasn't on a website, it was on Facebook or something, that people thought that Francis, some of these people were former students who thought Francis was a misstep and they want him to get back to the gold of Margot at the wedding.
Really?
But I don't think he's ever made a film that I didn't like. Although the person who preferred Margot at the Wedding over Francis Ha also said that his worst film was The Squid and the Whale. So maybe I just don't agree with him.
Listen to this at all.
I can't figure that person out.
The student in question predates you. He's pretty old now. That's all I'm going to say. But Francis Ha...
I hope that student trips and falls.
He just might. Francis Ha was terrific. I liked it more the more I thought about it.
Yeah.
No, it's a fun movie. I saw it recently. It's on Netflix Instant streaming right now, so everyone check it out. It's got a great Greta Gerwig performance. She's unbelievably charming.
Yeah, your mileage will vary by how much you like her, and we all like her,
she's
so obviously.
She's the whole show.
I love the whole... There's a whole sequence, without spoiling too much, where she does a spur-of-the-moment decision to go to Paris.
Yeah.
And the whole thing... It's only like 5-7 minutes of the movie. It's...
Oh.
What a great little moment.
That scene at the ticket window, to me, summarizes the whole movie.
What
is it okay if I spoil?
Yeah.
She's in Paris. She goes to a movie theater to see Puss in Boots, but it has already started. Like, everything about that is the wrong thing. To go see Puss in Boots, period. To go see it when you're in Paris. To go see it when it's already... She can't even get her shit together to make it to Puss in Boots on time. It summarized so much of what that movie is about, and I thought in a really smart detail, you know.
It almost feels like, and I know we've talked about this, it was the movie... If I made a movie...
Yeah.
In my 20s, it's like, that's the movie I felt like making. And
yeah.
You know, now that we have some perspective a little bit, it's kind of like, well, that.
But I also liked how the ending was warm and hopeful without being the usual Hollywood Dewey Ek Machina where she wins the lottery or something. That there was some hope at the end, and she progressed. She's...
Right. Yes. And again, that last shot, which we talked about, how I said I really liked the punchline, that it's, again, a nice little detail where it's like, there's progression, but, you know, and it's got that kind of butt thing to it.
I like when butt things...
You're a big fan of the butt things.
You in the butt. Backfield in motion.
I did not expect what is happening right now. For JB to start singing, doing the butt.
That's in the Spike Lee movie. That's in the School Days.
Wow, work that.
Look, your backfield in motion, doing the butt. Sex is sexy.
My number 6 may be higher on one of your lists, and that is Upstream Color.
Tabled.
All right. We'll do the butt later.
What? In the butt. My number 6.
Upstream Color.
Wow. My number 6
obtuse.
Is...
Obtuse.
Holy shit. My number 6 is Your Next.
That was lower on my list, so we can talk about it.
Yeah, we can talk about it now. So
it's untabled.
Do you want to say what you wanted to say about it?
No, go ahead.
I saw it based upon your recommendation.
Yeah.
I saw it. Did I see it in October?
3D.
It didn't come out in October, it came out in August. Did I see it in September? When the fuck did I see this movie?
You saw a preview.
Oh, no.
I did, but it was
only
a couple weeks.
The reason I'm stumbling right now is because I knew I saw it for a reason. I saw it before the... summer show. Thinking we might talk about it for the summer show. I saw it on your recommendation. It was a sleeper.
Sure.
It kind of came out, and no one was really seeing it, and it wasn't really talked about.
No.
And I didn't know what to expect, and you said, don't read about this. Don't read a review. Like, the less you know, the better.
Yeah.
And I saw it, and I was really... what a great, fun horror movie.
Yeah, it's my favorite horror movie probably since The Woman, which was only a couple of years ago, but...
Right.
Certainly one of my favorite... That was weird. Certainly one of my favorite horror movies of the last 10 years. I really loved it. It's not quite what you think it is. I loved the characters in it. I loved the way Adam Wingard directed it. And it's depressing because it was shelved for probably 2 or 3 years. possibly overhyped during that time, the way that, like, All the Boys Love Mandy Lane has become way overhyped, and now you see it, and you're like, well, what's the big fucking deal with that? Comes out, made some money, but not very much. A lot of other horror movies, including The Purge and possibly Texas Chainsaw 3D, made more than Your Next, which is super depressing to me.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of that is because, while I thought the trailer was really good, they were really marketing a home invasion movie, and a lot of people stay away from those. I do. but it's not, it's more than that.
No, there's lots of twists and turns.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to be the quibbler here.
Yes.
But I liked it.
Yeah.
I didn't love it.
Okay.
And I know exactly why. And I think a lot of movies this year suffered from this phenomenon. And I believe we've talked about this phenomenon. For the first hour, Your Next has me.
Yeah.
I just think it's so intriguing and interesting. And because I think I'm there at a horror film,
yeah,
when we get the big reveal,
yeah,
I found it completely disappointing. I would even argue that throws it into another category,
yeah,
not a horror film.
Yeah.
And
but can't it be about more than one thing?
Sure. I thought the same thing about The Conjuring, which I talked about this week in my column. For the first hour, it plays the haunting game, and it's an old house, and you have me for hours with just the noise and something's not right, and then there's the turn, and you lost me.
And I'm with you on The Conjuring for the reason that we sort of mentioned during Prisoners, again, is when you start to explain things or whatever, especially in horror movies.
Or Supernatural, for sure.
Right. Like, as soon as you start explaining stuff, or it becomes tangible, the way it sort of does in The Conjuring.
Yeah.
But now there's a thing that, it doesn't work as well as the hour of setup.
True. And in Your Next, I thought, they were basically bringing out the horriest cliché of the old dark house genre. That's where those movies start. What are all these strange things happening? Oh, it's this.
Okay.
Certainly souped up for the 21st century.
Yeah.
Love the blender.
Yeah.
But essentially, I don't know if I could talk about this without spoiling it.
Right. I understand what you're
saying.
Say
basically, it's the same denouement as The Cat and the Canary and the old dark house. It's
sure.
the same
yes.
thing.
And that mattered less to me than the other twist, which, again, we're talking about this.
Okay.
By the way, this is on my list. I don't know what the fuck you guys
are talking about. We'll tell you when we're done. I don't think it's a bad movie.
Yeah.
I think it's a very good movie.
Yeah.
I just didn't like it as much as the two of you.
Sure.
And I only went because you were screaming about it.
Yeah, no, I love it.
If one of the twists is what you're what I think you're talking about, this is so stupid. I loved it. I loved the twist of how things are kind of revealed.
Yeah.
I loved it. I thought it was great.
You can make an argument that it's yet another movie about the shitty American dream, too.
Yeah.
In a way, even that twist makes it more palatable to me as opposed to just another kind of genre.
I gotta defend the one that you're talking about, if only because it gave us the line about maybe marriage, which was the best line in the entire movie. Whatever. We're talking circles around.
This sucks.
It's new.
Johnny V is great, and Joe Swanberg does a great performance.
Yeah.
Man, is he every line
is perfect.
Hilarious.
Yeah.
And it's not even supposed to be necessarily, but the second time I saw it, sort of, again, knowing what I know, just the way that he says to his dad, so good. It's like, he's so great. And that's, I had said, like, I really love several of the characters. I don't love every character, but I love Charney B. I love Joe Swanberg. I love AJ Bowen.
Yeah.
And that's rare in a horror movie because usually you're there for kills or whatever, but I really loved a lot of the characters, and this is again a movie that I could see watching a lot.
And once the attack begins, we go in this well-worn territory, which I love, that when human beings are placed in a small place and they have to work something out under great stress, very similar to Night of the Living Dead, we're useless.
Right.
We will make every wrong decision in our attempt to stay alive.
And this one I thought was especially funny because of the family that it... I mean, Amy Simons' line about, like, no one ever... whatever. It's so funny.
This is what we're talking about.
All right. Anyway.
Number five.
J-Bones, yeah, you're five.
My number five? I thought it was the funniest movie of the year, and I went with such low expectations. And since I bought this new TV, I've been sort of using it as the test disc because it's a recent film and it was shot digitally, and I put it on just to look at what it looks like, and I wind up watching the entire thing. This is the end.
Tabled.
Okay. I'm not...
Wow, you guys put it even higher than me.
Table. It's not on my list, but it could have been.
Okay. Tabled. Oh, okay.
It's not on my list.
But wow, I'm really surprised.
It's really
all right, great. Save it.
It's really
for number four.
My number five, I'm guessing, also tabled. My number five is Gravity.
Tabled. My number five is Before Midnight. All right. I'm a huge fan, and I think this might... it's a great movie.
Okay, number four.
my response to it might be a little bit because it's a great trilogy.
Yeah, sure.
But I do think it's a movie... stands on its own. I think it's really, really good. And something we talked about after I saw it, it's not the movie I want it to be.
Which is why it's not on my list.
Right.
Really good movie. Because it's not...
It's an unbelievable movie, and it's an unbelievable series of films.
Yeah.
And the performances by Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy in all three movies, and the progression of them in their 20s and their 30s and now their 40s, and you get to this point... And yeah, the first movie is this hopeful, optimistic 20-something.
Right. It's the movie you want to see in your 20s.
Absolutely.
It's like, oh, you meet a girl on a train in Vienna.
Right.
And fall in love at night, and it's the best thing in the world.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And the second movie, it's the movie you kind of want to see in your 30s. Like,
right.
Maybe things aren't going the way you thought they would go.
But there's still hope.
There's still hope.
Right.
It's a reboot. It's a restart.
Right.
And, like,
right.
Things are optimistic. And this
right.
movie, without spoiling too much of it, is kind of a come down
yes.
to earth. And it's but...
Relationships are hard.
Relationships are shit.
Linkletter did all three.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he's terrific. This is the same as Fast and the Furious,
yeah.
because I never saw the first
two. You should.
These you should see.
Yes, these you should
Fast
see.
Fast and Furious, maybe not your bag, but
and
these
keep in mind that the
like.
First one, like, when you're 20s, this is your 20s. And 30s, this is your 30s. And the 40s, it's like, this. It's a heavier movie.
Yeah.
And some horrible, awful, I'll just talk briefly about this. There's some horrible, awful things that are said that kind of break your heart in this movie,
yeah.
even as a fan of the two characters. But
which, again, is why it's not on my list.
But even that being said, when the things are said or when what happens, what transpires, I couldn't help but have this smile on my face because it is done, the masterful work of
yeah.
Richard Linklater and the two actors, I mean, they have to carry so much. There's
yeah.
these crazy long takes.
Right.
It's shot really well. It's also, it kind of has a little Alexander Payne-esque where it's shot in a way that they're in Greece, but it doesn't feel like you're not
right.
in Mykonos and the
right.
white villages and all
right.
this other stuff. It's unbelievable.
And again, it just as an achievement, it's super impressive because only a few filmmakers have ever pulled that off. I know Michael Apted's other series.
Which is what this reminded me of that we're talking about.
Truffaut did it with the Antoine Daniel series, where you'd have...
Of course, I could have mentioned Truffaut and Apted earlier if you gave me a moment.
Kubrick wanted to do it with AI,
yeah.
but...
And Linklater supposedly has been doing it in secret for years, where he started filming a movie with a kid, and now it's about to come out.
That's
come
crazy.
Back to the same... actors and characters
yeah.
every 10 years or so. And so that's part of why their performances are so amazing. And like you say, when you're smiling as they're fighting, because the characters are so lived in
yeah.
that these two actors are so good at playing these parts that they just seem like real people. And, you know, they have screenplay credit on, I know, the second two movies. I don't think they do on the first. It was Linklater and a woman that wrote the first one. But Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy both have screenplay credit on the second two, and I wonder if that means that they all sat down and wrote together, or if that means that a lot of it was improvised. And I don't know the answer.
I read some trivia that said everything was scripted,
okay.
like, very much to the letter.
Which is amazing.
Which is amazing, yeah.
That makes the performances even more incredible.
It's just, it's an amazing series of movies, and maybe
yeah.
I'm giving this movie too much weight or too much credit. I hope they make a fourth, just because I'm a glutton for this
sure,
kind of stuff.
Sure.
And they haven't really had a misstep, even though this movie, again, is not necessarily what you want it to be.
Right.
It's not a misstep. It's just different. I hope to make a fourth, but I'm giving this the Lord of the Rings award for, you
yeah.
know, like, here's your
yeah.
best Oscar for three movies.
Right,
you know?
For sticking the landing.
Right.
I want
yeah.
to see them in their 50s.
I would love to.
I would love
to. My number four film I have screamed about endlessly. I want everyone to see it. Everyone I know who saw it, based on my original recommendation, based on my original column, has at least liked it. I've gone back and seen it again, and it was not a mistake that I loved it so much the first time I saw it. The film is Good Old Frida, another one of the terrific documentaries.
So you have three documentaries on your list.
No,
it's not a documentary?
No.
Oh.
It uses footage, but it's a fictional film.
My stars Gael Garcia Bernal. Your favorite actor from the Motorcycle Diaries.
I love the Motorcycle Diaries.
I know you do.
Deceptive Practice, the Magic and Mentors of Ricky Jay came very close to making my list.
But I love Ricky Jay, yeah.
I think that's just because I love Ricky Jay, and I know you said your problem with it is there's not enough of his
mentors. I finished the movie, yeah.
There's too much of his mentors.
I think it's
and
only
not enough.
You love Ricky Jay. I love listening to him talk because it makes me feel like I'm watching Magnolia.
And I got to tell you, I've now seen him live twice, and if you ever get a chance.
Oh, he's the best.
It's amazing.
Although, what does he do, magic or stories or what's his...
He's getting older, so the last time I saw him, there was this incredible slideshow up on the screen. He would ask the audience to pick a number. And once they picked... Ooh, that was weird. Once they picked a number, that picture would get bigger, and it would lead to a story and sometimes a magic trick. And so every show was different.
Wow, cool.
Because the evening can only contain so many picks, but he knows so many stories...
Tangent, real quick, because I did just finish the movie last night. Is the Steve Martin clip, is that real? Do you know what I'm talking about? Where Steve Martin bends the card as he's doing basically three-card Monty, and Steve Martin, to be funny, bends one of them so that the woman can obviously say, that's the red one. This is on TV. And then Ricky Jay fucking, like, bent card becomes the black. We're debating if that was real or if that was fixed.
I'm pretty sure that was a mind freak.
Back to good old
yeah, I was gonna say, which I desperately tried to see because I suspected it was going to be on your list and failed to do so. So I apologize.
And the other day, Sunday mornings in Chicago, there's a show called Breakfast with the Beatles on WXRT, and it's 2 hours of Beatles music. And out of the blue, Terry Hemmert, I guess I shouldn't be surprised because she's the MC of Beatlefest, out of the blue, she referenced it. And I was like, that's pretty obscure. And then she said, of course, that's from Good Old Frida, which is now available on DVD and Blu-ray.
And on Netflix Instant.
And
really?
Yeah.
It, you know, I went in with very low expectations because certainly I've seen some pretty awful homemade documentaries at Beatlefest. It was terrific in every way. It's exactly what a documentary should be. Every trick of documentarianism or contrarianism... Every tool that the documentary filmmakers used was used to good effect. Historical footage and talking head interviews and all this other stuff. And again, the thing I most like about it is in our age of reality television, there are several moments when the interviewer asks her a question and she says, no, that's private.
Now, my question to you, you're the biggest Beatles fan I know, and arguably in the state or the country, is your love of, and I'm a
not
big Beatles fan.
You're not willing to go.
You haven't met Kizashi yet.
Oh,
he's Japanese. He's a huge Beatles fan.
He owns George Harrison's corpse.
And he can eat 100 hot dogs in a minute.
Is your love of the Beatles coloring? That's all I'm asking. I'm a huge Beatles fan
also.
That
was the first question I asked myself because this was, I think, maybe the first Drunk on Foolish Pleasures column.
I believe it was.
And I prefaced the column by saying, I saw this terrific thing. I think it was blinded by my love of the Beatles, but I had two friends there who saw it.
Okay.
And we went to dinner, and I said, please tell me this isn't... And they said, no, it's a terrific film,
cool.
And it's people I trust. I can almost guarantee you'll love it. I know Adam recently name-checked it in one of his columns and said that he liked it a lot.
Yeah, I really meant to see it so we could have more dialogue about it, but I
Well, you really shit the bed, didn't you?
Listen, I'm very
this guy.
Sorry.
What's up?
What are we at? Four? My number four is a movie called I Declare War. It's a Canadian film that I saw many months ago. It's now available on DVD and Blu-ray. It's a movie about a group of young boys playing war in the woods, and that's the whole movie.
And this is something that they've obviously done a lot because there's all these rules.
Yes.
Throughout the film, there's some tricks being played.
Yes.
With reality.
Yes.
I saw it only because you recommended it so strongly. I think
okay.
I watched it on pay-per-view.
Okay.
Almost made my list.
Okay.
It's amazing.
Right? I'm not crazy, right?
No.
Okay. Because as the year went on...
Those two things are not mutually exclusive.
No, as the year went on and nobody talked about it, or even people kind of talked shit about it, I thought, well, maybe my memory of it is bad, or maybe I was just in the right headspace. So I actually rewatched it like a week ago, and I think that movie is about so many things.
It's so ambitious. I think some people can't wrap their heads around it. And like I'm going to talk about the next film on my list, it succeeded in being about what it was, very specifically. The way children who are this age play.
Yes.
The nature of play. And yet, at the exact same time, it worked as an analogy and a metaphor for seven other things.
I even thought it said really smart things about religion, which you didn't expect to play into. And I really thought it worked as a commentary on movie violence. Again, that certain images that we're seeing are very transgressive, and kids firing guns. We're obviously more sensitive to that now than ever, and the balloons are all filled with red paint. And to see a kid firing a machine gun and then get splattered with what looks like blood, it's disturbing. But then we tell ourselves, oh no, that's just their imagining. But then later in the movie, one kid is actually getting beat up, and then we're even more disturbed by that. But guess what? That's just pretending too, because they're actors in a fucking movie. Like, there's all these different layers.
There's a scene where one of the children is tortured.
Yeah.
That's almost impossible to watch.
Right. Even though that too is no different than when they're playing make-believe. You know what I mean?
Right. But that, because of the way it's filmed, because of the way it's scripted, right, because of the performances, that specific scene looks like documentary.
Yeah. Really great kid performances, too. Amazing casting, the way that they found the kids to play, the types of kids. We talk sometimes about how Stand By Me gets certain things right about the way kids talk and interact, and this movie does that as well. I think it's a really, really terrific movie that nobody is talking about, and I wish more people would.
I want to see it now.
Okay.
Can we pause the podcast and watch I Declare War?
It's a wonderful explanation for why some kids are so shitty.
Yeah.
Shitty parents?
No. It's not what you think it is.
No, not at all.
But as you watch the film, you're like, uh-huh, right, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Really good. Really, really good.
Should we wrap it up?
Yep.
That's it.
Okay.
My number four is This Is the End.
Oh, okay.
Which was JB's number
five. We had tabled it. Untabled.
It's untabled now. it's not something, I'm not a douchebag. This is not something I do on my lists, but I've noticed, I went back and looked at my previous list, and I was included a comedy, and this is by far the funniest movie that came out in 2013.
And I would argue, especially considering the gentleman involved, it's funny all the way through.
Yeah.
Because when I saw it the first time, I thought, this is going to run out of steam about 25 minutes in. And
I gave it an hour. And then
it doesn't. Yeah. If anything, it gets funnier.
Yeah, it's a really, really funny movie. I saw it way late. I didn't see it in the theater. I saw it at home, but even the home viewing experience was just hilarious. And you just have to see the movie. If you're a fan of these actors, I guess that's even a bonus.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I would say you don't have to be, but
it
definitely helps because it's one of those movies. It's like a hangout movie.
Where yeah,
it's like
for sure.
You're they hanging all out with them basically for 90 minutes. Yeah.
For the most part, I mean, obviously they take some creative liberties, and the whole Michael Cera thing is the most obvious example of like fantastic, fantasy.
Right, playing with the image, although Jonah Hill gets to do a lot of it too.
But Jonah Hill's playing with his image is so pitch perfect. Yes. Right.
And all the stuff about Franco I didn't notice until Patrick pointed it out. I don't think this is a spoiler. As you're watching the film, hopefully for the second time, watch his wardrobe.
Oh, yeah.
Who? Which one?
Franco.
Okay.
It's not a spoiler. He's wearing a different shirt in every scene.
he keeps changing his clothes, which is actually foreshadowing for one of the twists.
One of the best, funniest things, and that is Kenny Powell. What's his name?
Danny McBride
is just, I mean, so
which is amazing. Funny. Which is amazing because I feel like I'm pretty sure you and I have spoken of this, JB. We were kind of tired of the Danny McBride shtick.
I was done with it.
He kind of always would come in and do the same thing, and it's funny, but it's like enough of
it's grating. It can be.
This is the end. Suggests then in real life he's worse.
He's toning it down.
Yeah, he's toning it down for the movie.
The whole scene where he first appears and makes breakfast and kind of like confronts them all and just kind of
a lot of the trailer.
Yeah, it was, but it is like it's. I want to rewind it and watch it over and over again, especially like when Jonah Hill says there are many fatalities.
One of my favorite scenes of the year is his argument with James Franco about the magazine.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. It's pretty incredible.
So it is definitely, I think, the funniest movie that came out last year.
It is, but and again, you don't expect it to be about more than just sort of dick jokes. But it is. It's sort of a very sweet movie about friendship. There's a morality to it that if you act this way, I like that it sort of doubles down on its premise.
And suggests that you should be a good person and help each other.
Right.
That's crazy.
You know, go in the basement for the water.
A very, very entertaining movie. And I actually haven't seen it since the day it opened. And it's a movie that I feel like I would watch 20 more times. Every time say that keep watching it, it's like, oh, yeah, for sure.
If it comes on HBO, I don't think I could turn it off. Like,
I've seen it 3 more times on Blu-ray. It is one of the most stunning-looking Blu-rays I've ever seen.
It's, which is amazing, because that movie was shot for like $30 million, I think, $35. And it could have gone so wrong. And I think that's some of what all of
I've seen other movies by those gentlemen that did go wrong.
And this one has the potential to go even more wrong because it could have been so up its own ass and so sort of self-congratulatory. Inside. And like how you feel when you watch Couples Retreat or any Adam Sandler movie where it's like
his buddy's going on a vacation.
Yeah, like, oh, we got to pay to watch you guys dick around with your friends. And it's not that at all.
No, they're not lazy. It goes on it, which is what Adam Sandler is. It's like, we're going to be lazy and we're curious.
So hard to be smart and funny.
And again, to invoke the spirit of my son, his comment on the film, he liked it too.
Is Jake a ghost?
Is he a good
Oh, because he's not here. He's sitting here.
That makes more sense.
Right behind me? Why am I making pottery?
I'm amazed by his insight sometimes. He thought one of the smartest things they did was to make Jay Baruchel the focus. That was the first great decision they made, because Jay is our way in.
He's right. Yes, absolutely.
Number three, JB.
Yeah, good lord.
Number three.
We're flying through these.
And I think we. Well, I wouldn't say that.
Please.
My number three, I think, was further down in your list, and we tabled it. And for until December, this was my favorite film of the year. My number three film was Upstream Color.
Yes.
Much like I Declare War, I thought within its own reality, it existed as a film that, while far-fetched and odd and science fiction-like, worked as a story, although somewhat fantastical, but also served as a metaphor, specifically, I think, for what the nature of relationships are and what characterizes a bad relationship and the restorative power that a good relationship can have. I thought it worked on that level, too. I thought it was fascinating. I thought it was amazing to look at. And at times sort of reminded me of David Lynch.
Yeah.
Although sweeter. I don't find a lot of real sweetness in David Lynch. Ah, eating a worm. I can't imagine that. That's about as good as it gets. But the message at the end of this was one of hope, I thought.
It's not to, once again, name drop Adam Risky, but he had said in our, we wrote a thing about it, and he said something about how he had a hard time with it because it felt like he had to learn a new language as he was watching it, which I thought was a really interesting way of putting it, because it's a movie that is very confident in the way that it is made.
Yeah.
And part of that is, again, because Shane Carruth, you know, wrote it, directed it, stars in it. I think he wrote the score. I think he edited it. I mean, he really had his hand in everything. So it's very much the vision of one person sort of doing the whole thing. And like you had said, it can be confusing at times.
Yeah.
It was another movie that I showed to Erica the other night because she was trying to come up with the top 10 tonight. She hadn't seen it. And I thought there were things in it that she would respond to. So I waited until it was over. And then I showed her, I think, the director had done an interview with Slate or that it explains a lot of what was happening. But I waited until after it was over to show it to her. And then she said, oh, a lot of more of it makes sense. But I feel like even if you don't follow some of the more science fiction-y things, that there's enough emotionally in it to respond to, and that unlike a lot of movies, there's a lot of different ways I think that you can interpret a lot of the things you had said, that it could be a metaphor for relationships. I saw it sort of as a metaphor for the artistic process, that there's so much that you can kind of pull out of it. I think it's a really fascinating, really, really beautiful movie. And now we'll hear from Doug, who hates it.
Well, I know. I'm not a fan. It left you cold. I remember when you saw it. It
could.
I'll say this, and I swear I'm not being snarky. So happy that you guys like it.
Yeah.
Because it's like, it doesn't work for me, and that's fine. And I'm glad that it works for you guys. And maybe I need to see it again, although it seems like work to see it again.
Right.
It did leave me cold. But that's fine.
Yeah. It's definitely a movie with the potential to do that.
And I think that's what's great about movies. It's like we could find these things.
But I don't think it's a film with a lot of repeat potential.
No. No, not necessarily.
One and done.
And part of that is because it is about an emotional experience that, I don't know, there are other movies on these lists.
I would say it's beautiful. I mean, it's a very pretty movie. For sure.
What are we at?
Three. Sorry, is Only God Forgives.
Yeah, that's true. My number three is a documentary also called The Act of Killing, directed by Joshua Oppenheimer. Mm. Part of me wanted to put it as number one only because I think it's such a powerful movie and so unlike any movie I had ever seen. But I also feel like my number one shouldn't just be something I respect. It should be something that I love. And Act of Killing, I think, respect more than love.
Well, you said before,
it's a hard movie to love because it's about these fucking monsters.
Is this the movie, and I'm sorry, I don't think this is a spoiler, where they interview killers.
Yes.
And they kind of play act.
Yes. It takes these gangsters from Indonesia who, in 1965 and 1966, were responsible for slaughtering about 500,000 people. And it talks to the guys who did it and who remain unrepentant and actually proud of what they did. And they sort of brag about what they did. And one of them, specifically Anwar Kongo, who's sort of the lead of the movie, the one who's interviewed the most, is a big movie fan. And there's this old theater in town that a lot of the people used to go to. And so movies play a big part in the way that the documentary plays out, and that's another reason why I think it's such a brilliant movie, is because it too, like Stories We Tell, is also not just about what it's about, but about movies and about layers of reality. So what they do is they have a lot of these guys reenact some of their killings as scenes from different genres of movies. And that's cut in with Doc. It's unlike anything you've ever seen. And the last, I would say, 5 minutes are, without a doubt, the most powerful thing you will see in a movie this year. The whole thing just really left me speechless. I just think it's an incredible movie.
Wow. I remember when it played at the Music Box, and I so desperately wanted to get to it, and I just didn't.
Just out on DVD and Blu-ray, and it's from Drafthouse Films, and I want to say, and I apologize if I'm wrong, a lot of times their stuff shows up on Netflix Instant fairly quickly, cool. So keep an eye out. I'm sure I'll recommend it in Netflix's movie.
Is it a hard movie to watch? I know that's a kind of a loaded question.
Yes and no. Okay. I mean, it is because of what they're talking about, but it's also approached with, as fucked up as it is to say,
energy or
humor, almost. Some of it is just the absurdity of seeing this huge, heavyset Indonesian murderer who keeps playing the woman in different genres.
Jesus Christ!
And so there's this absurdity to it that you kind of have to laugh at. Just an incredible movie.
Wow.
Yeah.
My number three is The Wolf of Wall Street.
Tabled.
Okay.
Table that shit.
Consider it table.
I'm writing your films down on the list. That's what's taking me long. So now we're on two.
He's writing wrong next to each other.
I know. He's writing no next to all. No is your tie to number 10.
Well, next to, I just write, I don't think
so. Nice try, sucker.
I'm afraid I don't agree. My number two film.
Look at this asshole.
And we did a podcast on this. And as time went on after the podcast, I started to reassess the film.
Kick-Ass
and this was another, no, not in this lifetime. that this is another film where I started to watch it on Blu-ray on the new TV to look at the new TV, and I wind up watching the whole thing. My number two film is The World's End.
Yeah, that was my, it was lower. It was my number nine, and I have to say I'm at a disadvantage. I've still only seen it once, and I know.
You know, that's a movie you're going to have to see.
Even seeing it the first time, I thought, oh, I definitely have to see this
besides
a bunch
the
more
pub
times.
Thing, yeah. Which had to be explained to me after I saw it the first time. And my reaction to it was, and again, this was this phenomenon this year, that there were these movies where I loved the first hour and then the twist, and I didn't like the twist. And I had such a hard time with the robot aliens because I'm an older man, and that whole story about getting back together with your friends and trying to rekindle that thing that you cannot rekindle, it's like reheating a souffle, spoke to me so much. I just wanted it to be that.
Right.
But I've watched it a couple more times, and one of the more ambitious films of the year.
Sure.
One of the funniest films of the year.
Yes.
That film is so dense in the way it keeps shouting. It keeps shouting back to things that it already broke up. And I've gotten over the alien android robot thing because the last 10 minutes of that film, say what you want, they.
That's the same thing we said about This Is the End. Like, way to commit to the
ending.
Bit, guys.
Yeah,
right,
that's
right.
The phrase.
Yeah. Insanely good, just lower on my list, I think, because I haven't seen it enough times yet. But works as a super entertaining genre movie, very funny, amazing action sequences. Edgar Wright is such a good director of action.
Like choreographer.
And Simon Pegg doesn't get enough credit. In the Cornetto trilogy, or whatever we're calling them, he's playing three very different, very specific characters.
Yeah.
They're not alike at all.
I mean, so is Nick Frost, I would say.
Yeah, especially in World's End.
Yeah. Simon Pegg's performance is really, really good in the movie. And I appreciate the fact that not only does it work as just a fun genre movie, but that it is saying a lot of things, and a lot of them are kind of dark. But I appreciate that it's willing to go there.
Very dark. And you'd expect after Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, you would almost expect them to play the opposite character.
Right. Switch places. Right.
But it worked.
It didn't make my list, but it could have easily. And I think the reason it didn't...
Where was Hunger Games on your list?
That was number nine. Whatever, dude. Don't judge.
There's so many movies that come out.
Do you find fault with that statement?
In the position. I'm now putting you in the position where you have to agree with yourself.
I do. There's a lot of movies that come out. A lot of them are called Wolverine. I saw the movie, and I was turned off a little bit by the character that Simon Pegg plays.
Sure.
And
you know we knew that character, right, in high school?
Yeah. Okay. I mean,
you know who I'm talking about?
When
you're talking about me.
Over,
I don't like myself.
You know who it is.
Because I think I know
you absolutely know who it is.
My point simply is this. I know for a fact, and it's one of those things where I'll look back, you know, like you look at previous year's lists and you're like, how did War Horse make my list, you know?
I will stand up for War Horse.
There's always movies on my list that I'm like, I wonder...
Yeah,
like why did I put that? I put the King's Speech pretty high. Like what? Like
that's the fun thing about lists too. Not to get off on a tangent or interrupt what you're saying, but one of the fun things about lists is that they are totally fluid. And now I look at 2007 and I'm like, oh wow, There Will Be Blood nowhere on my list.
Right,
fascinating, an incredible movie. That it's always fluid, it's always changing. And movies that you didn't think you loved, all of a sudden you start to love, and other movies you're like, well, I put this on because it was, the end of the year, and I had just seen it, you know?
Right,
and
absolutely.
I've said this before, really great movies take a really long time.
I think that's the case with this one, because I saw it, and I'm like, I know, again, I love Shaun of the Dead, I love Hot Fuzz, and everything says I should love this, and something just was kind of like, it wasn't that I didn't like it, it was just something was just off, and I wanted to love it, and I didn't love it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know what, I know I'm going to see this like 10 more times, I'm going to own it, I'm going to watch it whenever it's on, I know it's going to have this slow burn on me,
right,
where I'll end up going back and saying, oh my god, in 2013 I didn't miss The World's End, right now I just can't, because it doesn't feel earned.
You will like it all 10 times.
Yeah. My number two?
Yes.
Inside Llewyn Davis.
I did not see that goddamn movie.
All right, so it'll be tabled.
It's my tied. I'm going to say it's tied for number one.
I like
on
it.
My list.
I like
too,
that. Okay? All right, cool.
My number two, which is on no one's list because
I assume you guys just thought it was okay, but I had a strong response to, was Captain Phillips.
Yeah.
I like that movie a lot. I think
tabled only because I don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, I know.
It's not about
it's a weird it does a weird thing. It's almost it's part procedural.
Yeah.
In how it kind of deals with these, you know, this real story that happened.
Yeah.
With this Somali pirates hijacking this cargo container ship off the coast of Somalia. Tom Hanks does a, I think does a really great job in his performance. I know something I just want to talk real quick about some bad part of the movie was the opening sequence between Tom Hanks and Catherine Keener. Yep. They have a conversation in a car that would never happen.
Right.
I don't know why Catherine Keener's in the movie. It just is a really weird
they're trying to establish, and I actually think they would have done a better job establishing that without that scene. They felt that they needed
right.
to ground him in like a family life
yeah,
or something. Right,
he has to look forward. To
I get it,
home.
But it just feels so like
there's a shot of
shoved
Catherine,
in. Like here's this.
There's a shot of Catherine Keener coming down the stairs in the house. It's in the first 5 minutes
yeah.
of the movie, where it's like because it's time to leave. We're going to the airport or whatever. It's literally just somebody coming downstairs, right?
Right?
It's in all the trailers, and I think it's A to tell you that Catherine Keener is in the movie, but it also. When they cut it with certain music and with the other images that you're seeing, it seems like there's urgency. Like
right.
someone just called her and said, your husband is being held hostage.
Five.
So now
she's
running down the stairs.
Yeah.
Right.
And when I saw the movie, I had seen the trailer and I just assigned that meaning to that shot.
Of
and
course.
Then I saw the movie and I'm like, that's the context for this shot?
Very right.
Marketing.
But aside from that, and that's kind of my only quibble with
the
movie, I just think it's a great procedural. I like the performances are all across
yeah.
the board unbelievable. These actors who play the pirates, I mean, how do you even begin? And I think it comes from a real place, and that's really...
Yeah, that guy, the main guy was, I think, driving, he was like a chauffeur.
In Minneapolis or something, yeah.
And that's an amazing performance.
Yes.
Unbelievable.
And not just... The villainy of the beginning of it and the really disturbing I'm the captain now, which
right.
is in the trailer.
Right.
But his last few moments
yes.
yeah.
when he's presented with the reality of the situation
yes.
is just incredible.
And I will say, and this is, I think, where it really stuck with me was the last 20 minutes of the movie, but specifically the reintroduction of Tom Hanks. I mean, it's not a spoiler that the Tom Hanks is rescued.
Right.
This is a real story.
We've talked about it in various ways. The scene where he's in shock.
I've never seen that in a movie before. I've seen people in shock in movies before, but I've never seen that. And it was, I welled up. I was
yeah.
so emotional. Like,
yes.
this is unbelievable. And not only his performance, but the weird, again, talk about Alexander Payne plucking
yes.
a person from real
yes.
life. That Corman, the woman, the female
yeah.
doctor
yeah.
that is like just... going through the motions, like, sir, can you hear me? I'm cutting your clothes
more
off.
More than one person has brought... as soon as we saw it, Erica brought that up, too. Like, do you think that was an actor? Do you think they got a real person? That so many people have responded to
right.
her performance.
It
maybe because of the
yeah.
way it bounces off of his.
But the minute you see it, you say, that's what it really looks like.
Exactly. And what it really feels like.
I love, it's no secret, I like kind of war-type movies and procedurals, and whenever they show the... military involved, and when the SEALs come on the ship and take over, like, it's just all those types of things really I really respond to. So I had high expectations for it, and when I saw it, I was like, wow, this movie, I thought, really delivered. I liked
yeah.
it a lot.
I had high expectations, and I thought it exceeded the expectations. It very nearly made my list.
Cool.
Yeah, the only reason it's not on my list, and I knew this the night that I saw it, and I think we saw it opening night, was like, that was very well done. That was...
You want every Hollywood
movie. I don't have any problems with that movie,
right.
but for whatever reason,
yeah.
I just...
Didn't click.
Yeah, it's like I didn't love it, but not because there's anything wrong with it. I will say, you know, lots of places I'm sure brought this up, that it's amazing how tense it is, even though you know the outcome.
Right.
But I remember sitting through it and forgetting a lot of the true story. And so I went into it expecting the whole movie is on the boat and it's all Tom Hanks trying to get the pirates off the boat.
Right.
And again, spoilers, maybe at 30 to 45 minutes, they're off the boat. And
yeah.
it's like, oh shit, what happened after this? And I couldn't remember the real
right.
story and how much of it takes place
in that tiny, claustrophobic
tiny, horrible. And the way that it continues to escalate the tension based on how small that environment is.
And that whole sequence with, you have to be in that seat.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hitchcockian.
Yeah. Yeah. An incredibly well done movie.
Cool.
And now we need some sort of opening salvo or some sort of theme music here.
2013 was a year in cinema.
Here's what put this movie over the top. Here's what...
It's over the top.
It vaulted it vaulted it to the top spot. Because last week I actually bought a CD, which I don't do very much anymore. And I bought the soundtrack to this film, and I've been listening to it in the car.
Yeah.
And through the soundtrack, I'm revisiting the film, and it was your number two.
Yeah.
Inside Llewyn Davis is amazing from two filmmakers who are amazing for hitting it out of the park.
I'm so pissed at myself that I have not seen this movie yet.
It's about so many things. They didn't use Roger Deakins, who they usually use.
Right.
I forget his name, I saw him on some TV show, and he's got a very, very foreign-sounding name. And now that it's opening wide, you're seeing scenes from it on TV.
Yeah.
The look of this film is amazing.
It looks awesome.
The performances are amazing.
Yeah. It looks amazing.
You had said heavy hitters. One suspects they wrote the middle sequence for John Goodman because he's their good luck charm or something. But I actually thought that sequence worked, at least to get the character to Chicago. Because the scene where he auditions and F. Murray Abraham's response is one of the many highlights of the film. I know you said one of your favorite movie moments was his performance of Queen Jane.
Yeah.
Which is his audition.
Yes, and the response after.
I mean, it sounds great.
There's a scene where...
You guys are talking about a movie that's probably my number two or number one.
There's a scene where Oscar Isaacs, Justin Timberlake, and Adam Driver record a novelty song.
It's the best.
That's one of the funniest things I've seen.
Can Adam Driver sing?
He doesn't have to.
He doesn't have to.
He does something way better.
And that's on the soundtrack.
And that's really funny.
That's the one you hit me beat.
Timberlake has a co-writing credit on that song, too.
Yeah.
In case you need another reason to
suggest it's one of the five best movies that the Coen brothers have ever
really?
Made. I would easily put it in the top.
Oh, gosh.
Film. I don't even know where to begin that. That's a great conversation. Yeah.
That's almost an impossible list. The thing is...
Maybe that should be the weekend weigh-in.
No, the weekend weigh-in, by the way, this week is going to be What's Your Top 10, so don't fucking post it in the comments of this.
Oh, yeah. Put that in the description.
That happens every year, and that's fine. Let's use the comments of this podcast to talk about our choices, and then the weekend weigh-in will be Give Us Your Top 10. The weird thing about Llewyn Davis is it seems so small and seems minor. It's just about this one guy, takes place over a couple of days, feels sort of meandering at times, and I had one friend who said it was confusing. And so it's a movie where the greatness kind of sneaks up on you. You know what I mean? Like, Douglas, I know what your number one is going to be by process of elimination. That's a movie that sort of announces its greatness. Like, look at me! And Llewyn Davis doesn't. And so I think it's going to take time to catch up with some people.
All the music was recorded live.
Yeah.
So
Oscar Isaac, that's a movie that doesn't exist without Oscar Isaac. Like, you find a guy who's that good of an actor who also can play and sing that well is amazing. And I remember going all the way back to Sucker Punch, which was sort of the movie that came on, where he came on everybody's radar, you singling him out and saying, I really like that guy that played Blue. And
By the way, you're pointing at Doug. That's right.
Doug.
So I'm contributing to this
basically
conversation about
Inside Llewyn Davis.
Oscar Isaac was on The Daily Show last night.
Oh, I haven't watched it yet.
And I guess there was a screening of the film, and Isaac related that when Jon Stewart came up to him after the film, the first thing Stewart said was, I thought someone so talented would be taller.
It's amazing how much that movie has stuck with me.
Yeah.
That we watched it, and it was like, hey, that was really good, but I couldn't really get a handle on how I felt about it. And it took time for me to process, and more than almost any movie this year, it has really stuck with me.
And now that it's opening wide, I want to see it again on a bigger screen.
Yeah.
To enjoy the cinematography even more.
Yeah.
Do you see a screener? Is that?
Yeah.
Yeah, really well done. And feels obtuse at times. But
yeah.
But then the more you think about it, the more you sort of say...
It works itself out. Yeah.
My number one is a movie that we tabled, and J-Bones will not like this, but it is The Wolf of Wall Street. directed by Martin Scorsese. Douglas, you have this.
I did.
Somewhere else on your list.
I had it number three.
Yeah.
I saw this fairly recently, as we all did, because it just came out. That's a really dumb thing to say. So it's open the conversation about this number one movie for Patrick. I apologize. You had made a comment about how the trailer,
yes,
which is about 2.5 minutes, feels like you're on cocaine.
Yes.
And I've never tried cocaine, but
before tonight,
3 hours, you're on cocaine, yeah. And it's not a... I want to try cocaine, is my point.
I see, Mr.
That's the famous George Carlin quote. You know how cocaine makes you feel? It makes you feel like having more cocaine.
I, for the longest time this year, did not have a clear number one, and I didn't know how the year was going to shake out. And then on Christmas Day, The Wolf of Wall Street comes out, and I think I saw it the day after. I don't remember. And I thought, thank goodness, because here's a movie that, like I was just saying about your number one, I think definitely announces itself as being a
great
movie. Yeah. Scorsese can be hit or miss for me, and I don't think he ever makes a bad movie, but I don't think he always makes great movies. His movies are always worth seeing, but sometimes I have more problems with them than I did.
But sometimes they're The Aviator.
With this one. And it just was great to sit down and feel like here's a 70-year-old guy saying, I'm going to show you fuckers how it's done. And it is so confident and energetic and entertaining. And like I have said about, I think, Tarantino's movies in the past, that the reason that it's number one, for me at least, is because it's the movie that more than any other movie this year combined substance with an approach that is incredibly watchable and entertaining, that it's so much fun to watch, which, again, is not the same as condoning what they're doing in the movie, because if you're one of these people who says that the movie celebrates that, I say fuck you. The movie does not, and I'm sorry that you think that, but it's still super entertaining to watch. It's so incredibly well-directed. And again, more than any movie this year is about the shitty American dream.
So that's 2013. It's the shitty American dream.
It is. And what an indictment this movie is, especially that last shot.
Yeah. It's the performances in this movie across the board are, and I'm not just talking about Margot Robbie's assets. I'm talking about the performance of Leonardo DiCaprio, who I'm not even, like, the biggest fan of.
Yeah.
But
I'm not always either, but between Django Unchained,
yeah,
and this movie.
And now he's quitting.
You didn't let right? me.
Yeah, no, he came out and said, like, he's going to stop acting to do, like, Save the Tiger or something.
All right.
Yeah, no.
Okay, right. Sure.
And even, what's his name? Jonah Hill. Who yeah. I'm not the hugest fan of. In fact, I mean, going back to Superbad, there's grading Jonah Hill.
Right.
And he's fine in Moneyball. And he obviously has taken turns as a more respectable actor. And he almost seems like his first appearance is a little much, but then the character, yeah.
Yeah, well, he definitely makes some choices that could easily have backfired in the fact that it works. And again, even the small performances, Jon Favreau shows up just because it's fucking Jon Favreau. Rob Reiner, I actually thought, is really, really good.
Yeah.
And doesn't get to act that often and usually isn't really good, but is really good. And we talked last week about how much I liked the Kyle Chandler performance.
That's what I was going to say. And
the McConaughey performance.
There's a scene where you talk about McConaughey, it's one scene.
Yeah.
Hits it out of the park. There's a scene where the Leonardo DiCaprio character makes a decision, and the camera turns, and we see Rob Reiner's reaction to that decision, and it's great.
I don't want to spoil anything, but Rob Reiner's final reaction shot is inside of a courtroom, I believe, and it's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Do you like the movie any more now, or are you still stuck on?
There are scenes.
Has it grown anymore?
There are scenes that I love.
Yeah.
Maybe I need to see it again. And I don't mean to piss on your parade, because you have such love for this thing.
Yeah.
And everyone I know went to see it and loved it. So I realize I'm alone here. I thought it was overlong.
Yeah.
I thought it was shrill. I thought it was repetitive. I thought it was like someone shouting at me for 3 hours. I respect Scorsese's skill. As we discussed last week, the scene where DiCaprio has to go down a short flight of brick steps is amazing. It's amazing filmmaking. But I like parts of it more than the whole.
Sure.
I think the whole sequence, it's so interesting because I saw this movie with my brother-in-law, and we were both before the movie, like, are we ready, like, for 3 hours?
Yeah,
like,
right.
We have to, like, pee before we go. Like, you know, like, just mentally prepare yourself because we had no idea what to expect. And not to, again, disagree. Obviously, we all have our opinions. But I felt like it went by so quickly, and I never once looked at my watch or, you know, I mean, other movies on my list that I loved this year, I found myself kind of saying, oh, this feels like, even Nebraska, a movie I saw today and really liked, I felt like, did this really need to be two solid hours
long? In Adam's column, he said it was a three-hour movie that felt like 90 minutes.
Right.
Because he had other movies that were 90 minutes that felt like 3 hours.
So I felt, and not only that, but I wanted to, the Kyle Chandler performance, the whole scene, there's a couple of scenes specifically that stick out to me. And this is why it's a three-hour movie. There's a scene that takes at least 20 minutes, if not longer, that is they're taking these lemons, these old Quaaludes, and it's he goes to the country club and makes a phone call. It hits him, and he's talked about the stairs. And everything, it's almost real time, but it's fascinating to watch. And the scene where the FBI agents, Kyle Chandler and the other guy, come visit DiCaprio on his yacht.
Yeah.
And it's such a great little mini-movie, that scene, where it starts, and you think it's going one direction, and it just kind of takes a turn, and it's so great.
And the punchline of the yacht scene, I think we talked about this last week, was at the very end, there's a shot of Kyle Chandler on the subway, and you're not quite sure how Scorsese wants you to interpret that shot.
Which, again, to me, is the mark of good filmmaking and not...
Ambiguity is good. Yeah, no,
right. It's deliberate ambiguity as opposed to just...
Of course.
Well, what do you think it means?
The shrug. The artistic shrug.
Douglas, your number one movie.
My number one movie is Gravity. And I've talked about this briefly on the Tommy Boy podcast, I think, which is the appropriate place to talk about one's number one movie. To me, the movie is... it's about space and about astronauts and things like that, but which is what initially attracted me to the movie because I love outer space, I love astronomy, I love the stars, I love all those types of things, I love NASA. But it's not about that. It's about life and accomplish and human, the will to live and survive and struggle. And it's a simple movie that it's unbelievable. And I don't know what... I don't want to be too verbose or whatever, just or effusive in my praise, but I really had such an emotional response to it where I just was blown away. I saw it in the 3D for the first time.
Like they call it the 3D.
The 3D.
Everyone agrees that if there's any film that you're going to see in IMAX in 3D, this film
I missed out. I saw it a couple weeks later. My in-laws were in town and we're babysitting, so we had a night out, which was the first night out in months, and we actually missed the IMAX because I think Thor had come out and kicked it from IMAX. But we did see it in 3D, and the 3D was so interesting because it wasn't a stick.
Right.
It was the depth. It was the...
It wasn't a t-shirt cannon.
Right. It was the depth of field, and I really, really responded. And I know it's not for everyone. In fact, I had a quick email conversation with Adam Risky, who did not respond to it. Yeah. And he kind of didn't like it. And I think that's okay because, again, my response to it isn't like... The ridiculousness of the practicality of the logic.
Right.
It's not, even though I think that those things in its own world kind of make sense. And I know that respected people like Neil deGrasse Tyson and other astrophysicists said, well, this isn't real because this and that and the other. It's like, well, I think if you pick any movie...
I don't remember them weighing in on Star Trek Into Darkness.
Well, I think if you pick any movie about some profession, the professionals in that field would be like, well, that's not how...
And Rex Reed hated Raising Arizona because kidnapping children isn't funny.
Right. So, I mean, take that for what it's worth in terms of, like... And I think even Neil deGrasse Tyson realized, like, maybe I should have, like...
Well, he said at the end of it, he had this... laundry list of like and this and this and this, but I still like the movie.
Right, exactly. Right. And I again, when it sounds, it's so simplistic and so almost trite. But when I don't want to spoil it, but the end of the movie, how it just is this revelatory thing.
Right.
That I want to like stand up and like cheer because it's like it's just triumph.
Yeah. Which ultimately, a lot of art is supposed to inspire in us, and very little art does. Gravity, I was hoping, would start a trend, along with Captain Phillips to a lesser extent, the first 20 minutes of Riddick to a greater extent, and also something like I Declare War, a film that has the guts and the skill to have a very narrow focus, mm-hmm. almost like a short story, because I find what bad movies do is they just add more plot.
Right.
There's just all these other things happen.
Right.
Whereas why don't we take one thing and really fully explore it, which was the thing I liked best about Gravity, that and the one shot that took me forever to figure out how they did it, and my guess proved correct. I found something on the internet that I was like, I got that one right, because earlier there was a shot in Inception where I thought I had it.
Floating through the space station? Yeah. How'd they do it? I don't know if I know.
Apparently, she's swimming, and then they digitally removed any artifact that she's in the water.
I was amazed to find out that basically only their faces were real in all those space shots, that everything else is CG.
It's unbelievable, and I'm not even sure I'm a fan of that necessarily, but if nothing else, I just am blown away.
I liked not knowing until after the movie.
Right, because it isn't.
I would have been distracted going into it knowing that.
It's a technological achievement, and
that was what I was going to say. I had it as, I think, my number four or number five, is that it obviously, I think, to me, is the most technically impressive movie of the year, and that while we often go to movies for story and for characters, that sometimes just an incredible sort of visceral experience can have more of an impact than a lot of other things. And for me, that was Gravity this year, that it was just the most amazing experience I had in a theater this year.
But how ironic and how great that all of the CGI and all of the technology is being used ultimately
to service a story.
To service something that's talking about humanity.
Right.
That it's not just a fireworks display.
Right, it's not just a roller coaster, and I think that there is an experience. You can enjoy it on that level.
Yeah.
But it's also, I mean, again, so much more for me. It really moved me.
Cool.
And a great performance by Sandra Bullock.
Yes. That's it. Wow. Awesome.
Holy moly.
Good lists, guys.
Gravity's tied with Llewyn Davis and her and everything else I did to see. So.
Some overlap, but not a ton. That's cool. I like when that happens.
Yeah.
We have different lists.
Well, now we've got a whole other list.
I have now written down the lists. And again, this proves this was a great year for movies.
Yeah. In the past, we've gone through our lists again. Should we do that? So everyone can hear it at the end.
Sure.
Put together. All right, Douglas, go ahead.
Number 10, Nebraska. Number 9, The Hunger Games: Catching Fire. Number 8, Prisoners. Number 7, Fast and Furious 6. Number 6, You're Next. Number 5, Before Midnight. Number 4, This Is the End. Number 3, The Wolf of Wall Street. Number 2, Captain Phillips. And number 1, Gravity.
Jay Bonds?
Number 10, it's a tie between Frozen and No. Number 9, 20 Feet from Stardom. Number 8, American Hustle. Number 7, Nebraska. Number 6, Frances Ha. Number 5, This Is the End. Number 4, Good Old Frida. Number 3, Upstream Color. Number 2, The World's End. Number 1, Inside Llewyn Davis.
For number 10, I had a tie, You're Next and Drug War. Number 9, The World's End. Number 8, Spring Breakers. Number 7, Stories We Tell. Number 6, Upstream Color. Number 5, Gravity. Number 4, I Declare War. Number 3, The Act of Killing. Number 2, Inside Llewyn Davis. And number 1, The Wolf of Wall Street. Good lists, everyone. Thank you guys very much for listening to this epic show. I love doing this show.
And please remember, there's so many movies that come out.